Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and earned a BA in European History from the Washington and Lee University. From 1979 to 2015, he was the Detroit Tigers beat writer for the Detroit News. And in 2015, he was awarded the J.G. Taylor Spink Award by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum. His third book, which was just released, is entitled Number 3 and is about Ellen Trammell. His name, Tom Gage. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Tom Gage, who from 79 to 2015 was the Detroit Tigers beat writer for the Detroit News. Tom, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Good to be here.
A Michigan Sports Hall of Fame icon.
Well, I don't know about that. Let me add one thing. You're absolutely correct about 79 to 15, but I also want to claim a little bit of 1976 because it was such a joy to watch the bird pitch.
Success has a thousand fathers and failure is an orphan. You didn't mention the 2003 when you lost 119 games.
That's true.
Okay, let's start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please.
Well, I grew up in Grosse Pointe. I loved baseball. I was a left-handed third baseman in Grosse Pointe Little League, and that's about it. I mean, I always, growing up and going to Mare School, which is right in the village off of Kercheval there, I loved, you know, I always, I'm still friends with my fifth and sixth grade teacher, Bill Mestaw. He was just out of Michigan, and we had a small classroom, and he gave us this great vocabulary test. He gave us 25 words and just said, I don't care how you use them, just write a short story about them and using them all. And it was the best lesson in creative writing, even for 10-year-olds, you know, whether we were writing about monsters or whatever. And that's how I really, you know, I didn't need to be that creative for baseball. I mean, I could write anything I wanted to for the vocabulary list. But to this day, I tell Bill that was the start of my writing career.
And the start of your baseball watching career was June 24th, 1956, Briggs Stadiums, Tigers play the Orioles. What do you remember about that game?
Section 123. And I remember it being a doubleheader and my dad not wanting to stay for the second game. But in later years, once in a while, I would go down to the section where I thought it was and look out from it, because I just remember, you know, every kid who sees Tiger Stadium or used to see Tiger Stadium for the first time, I mean, what made the big impression? The grass. And I think it made more of an impression in later years when I would go through to the upper deck, through the corridor, you know, those cramped corridors and then the tunnels. But, boy, I just loved being there for that any time. And for a kid who was 8 years old, I mean, I'll never forget it. My dad was not a baseball fan. His two brothers were. So when he was growing up, he was an engineer. His two brothers were baseball fans. And they would go and watch, keep track of the players. And my dad would look up at how the stadium was constructed. He'd be looking at the girders. And so he missed many a home run that way, I believe.
We're talking to Tom Gage, who covered Major League games in 54 parks, more than 5,000 games. And that first game you went to, Gage, might have been the only one you ever paid to get into.
Well, no, I paid for a few more because I always seemed I would see a grand slam. One of my claims to fame, and it's not much, is that I saw Ted Lepsio hit a grand slam for the Tigers. And I would see pitchers hit home runs, too. Lou Slater. I don't know if you remember Lou Slater. He was a good hitting pitcher, and that even went on in other ballparks. I remember before I got into the writing business, I visited a college friend of mine in Cincinnati, and Rick Wise was pitching for the Philadelphia Phillies, and it was in June of 71, and Rick Wise threw a no hitter and hit two home runs in that game. 2 years later, almost to the date, I'm visiting the same friend in Cincinnati. We go to the ball game, and it's against St. Louis, and Rick Wise is pitching for the Cardinals. And Rick Wise takes a no-hitter into the ninth inning until Morgan breaks it up with a one-out single to center. And I remember when I was covering the Tigers and Sparky came to Detroit, I told him, Sparky, you might not want me covering your teams because I've only seen two of your games, and you only had one hit in the two games combined.
1970 to 76, you wrote for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. You started at $125 a week. What did they have you cover?
They had me cover news to begin with, and I thanked them for that. I was just happy to get a job because I didn't have any kind of... I mean, I worked on my college newspaper, and I'd worked on my high school newspaper, but those weren't really qualifications. What I needed was somebody with a lot of patience as my editor, and luckily I had it. It was one of the biggest breaks of my career because here I'm in New Orleans covering a city that I don't know. My dad had been transferred to New Orleans. He worked for Chrysler, and he was an aeronautical engineer, so there was a big project going on down there at the time. So when I ended up working in New Orleans, again, I'd been to the city, but I didn't know, and I didn't know the news of the city. Well, New Orleans loves its elections, and my first assignment was for 8 candidates, I believe, for drain commissioner, and I didn't know how to cover that, and I didn't know how to write it. I took notes, and I probably took down everything they said, and I went back, and I told my Night City editor, Joe Darby, and I'll always remember his name. I said, Joe, I don't know how to write this. You're going to have to help me. And he handed me an outline on basically a pyramid style type news story. He said, just make sure you catch people with your first paragraph. And that really became, and that was great advice because people don't usually read, especially, they don't jump with the stories. They don't continue to page 11. They hardly ever go to the jump. And they don't really read the entire story. So you gotta hook them with that first paragraph, and Joe was the one who told me that. And I wrote the best drain commissioner story I could.
We're talking to Tom Gage, who was world-class, and one of the things he's known for is his leads. And I'm Jack Wasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and with Tom Gage, who's been our eyes and ears for 40 years about the Detroit Tigers. You started covering them in 1976, and in like late April, this sensation gets called up, Mark the Bird Fidrich.
Yeah, and he was special. He really was. And here I am. I covered for about 6 weeks from the middle of July to the end of August, and that included the Yankee game for which he's, the televised Yankee game. But the moment I remember him for, Jack, is he was facing, I believe it was either the Angels or the A's, whoever Claudel Washington was playing for at the time. I believe it was Oakland. And Claudel Washington wanted to slow the Bird down. He wanted to dictate the pace of the game. So he got into the box and out of the box, and he adjusted this and adjusted that and stepped out again. And there's Fidrich on the mound, down on his crouching. And just looking at it, really was kind of a spectacle because everybody knew what Washington was doing. He was trying to take the pace of the game away from Fidrich. And Fidrich was just marveling at this and also getting annoyed. So finally, when Claudel Washington was ready to hit, he stepped back in. Fidrich wound up and threw a pitch right at his knees. He knew exactly where he was putting it. And it wasn't meant to hit Washington because you don't want to hit a hitter in the knees. You want to plunk him on the thigh or on the side. But the knees can can do some damage. But he knew that he put it just close enough to make Washington dance away. And afterwards, I went down to the clubhouse to talk to Washington about that, and he said, that kid knows how to pitch. And he said it with such admiration. That's the thing about Fidrich. He was, some people thought he was a clown and a spectacle, and yeah, he was an entertainer, that's for sure. But he was also a very mature pitcher and a guy who knew exactly what he could do on the mound.
There's so many rumors, Tom, about what happened to him. You know, he was dancing with somebody's girlfriend, all kind of stuff. What happened to him?
Well, whatever happened to him happened at a spring training I was not at. And I believe he was clowning around in the outfield and trying to make some catches and hurt his knee. He was never the same after that. But he did come back eventually, and with the help of Jim Leland. And I remember one of the greatest games when he was going downhill, and it was about, I think it was either 79 or 80, and he threw a great game. I mean, he was not the same. He didn't have the snap on his pitches that he did. He wasn't an overpowering pitcher. He was a location pitcher. But he did need some velocity to help with that. And he lost that. I mean, and he just looked rusty, but he came back in September of one of those years and threw a great game against the White Sox. And Leland was sitting with his mother near the Tiger dugout, and Bird went, after the final pitch, he went right over to Leland and hugged his mother. And it was just a wonderful moment. Those guys were close because Jim had helped him through some tough times. And that was probably the greatest moment of Bird's attempted comebacks, and it was a special moment to see.
Speaking of special, we were blessed to have another sensation, a 60-year sensation with Ernie Harwell.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and everything, he was the kindest man I ever met, always thinking nice thoughts about you. There were times, I mean, I'm probably one of the few people who ever saw him angry. He was in the clubhouse one time, and the Tigers were having a Kentucky Derby pool, and he signed up for it, and one of the veteran pitchers said, Ernie, it's only for the players. And Ernie said something that you wouldn't expect Ernie to say, and he said, you know, I don't need to be in your, I don't know if it was a bleeping pool or just your pool, but you could tell Ernie was angry. Because he wanted to be part of the pool, and he was accustomed to being part of what was going on in the clubhouse. And for him to be told that he wasn't allowed in the pool irritated him. And I thought rightly so. Who's going to deny Ernie Harwell a spot in the Kentucky Derby pool? Well, the players did, and he was upset. And I remember that made an impression on me because I thought, well, maybe, you know, you're obviously an angel, Ernie, but you can react the way everybody else reacts.
He was famous for saying that whenever you have a choice of being right or kind, always choose kind.
And he was often, and he was right to think that. I remember one time I was driving out early to the ballpark in Anaheim, and Ernie was going out to the ballpark early, and I pulled my car around, and he kind of flagged me down, and we got into the car to drive. It was a very short distance, and the first thing we came up with was a traffic light. And he said, go slowly, because I want you to get the red. And I thought, he had asked me how I was doing that day, and my son was having ear surgery, you know, the tubes, but it was his first time having them, and so I was concerned. So I thought, why would Ernie want me to get a red light? He wanted to say a prayer he wanted me to take my hands off the wheel for him to say a prayer for my son who was going through surgery that day. And I just thought, what a kindness. And but that was Ernie. He was just a wonderful man.
Talk to us about Ernie Harwell's recall and his memory, Tom.
Oh, well, Ernie kept it simple with his broadcast. But he had a great way of just giving you the exact information you wanted. You never knew. You never had to wait for the score. You never had to wait for the situation. And of all the things that he ever said on the air, I just love the let's listen to the bedlam. when the Tigers won the pennant, and that's just classic. His recall was amazing. He knew baseball, not just currently, but the past. And it was always a history lesson. I had many a lunch and many a meal with Ernie, and it was always educational.
All right. Speaking of, Ernie had a great way of giving you exactly what you wanted. Let's talk about another entertainer that always didn't give you what you wanted, Sparky.
Sparky was special. I mean, he was, yes, he was an entertainer, but he changed over the years. You know, Sparky was great with the writers, but Sparky didn't like spring training, and he didn't like the length of spring training. And I could, if I hadn't even known what day it was in February or March, I would know from Sparky's reaction to having us around. When we would first get to spring training, the three beat writers who covered the Tigers, he would say, "Well, there they are, three of the best." And late in March, he would say, "Well, there they are, three vultures." You know, because he was losing patience. He wanted to get away from Florida. He liked February spring training because he could teach and go through the motions. But the games, many times he would go to the clubhouse during the game, and we were able to talk to him during the game. Sparky treated everybody well. I mean, Jack, there's that great story of in 84 when the Tigers were 34-5. And again, this was out in Anaheim. And Sparky lived in north of L.A., so before getaway day, it would be the only night he would spend in the Tigers hotel in Anaheim. So he was on the bus, and I was on the bus going back to the hotel. And we got off the bus, and we're going through the lobby of the hotel, and a man comes up, somewhat inebriated man, comes up to Sparky, and, "Hello, Sparky, I'm so-and-so from Dayton, Ohio. I was a Big Red Machine fan." "Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much." He said, "Oh, boy, did I love that team," he said. "By the way, what are you doing now?" And Sparky just, it was, here he is, 34-5. The Tigers are the toast of baseball. This guy professes to be a great baseball fan, and he doesn't know that Sparky Anderson's the manager of the Tigers. And that just shows you, I mean, Sparky loved to be reminded to be humble. He always had that sign in his office: about every 24 hours, the world turns over on itself. And it gave him perspective. Of course, the Tigers then went from Anaheim. They won the next day and took that 35-5 record up to Seattle and lost three straight games. But, that Sparky would always have a great reaction to being to reminders of his own humility.
Yogi Berra once said about Sparky, "Sparky was old when he was young." And we're talking to Tom Gage, a master storyteller from the ballparks of America. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Tom Gage, who in 2015 was awarded the J.G. Taylor Spink Award by the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum. Phenomenal honor. Let's follow up on the 1984 magical season. Jack Morris just got into the Hall of Fame a couple months ago. Tell us about Morris.
Well, Jack got off to a great start that year. I don't have the numbers with me, but he was winning left and right. And among the media, there were talks of possibly a 30-win season. And that kind of went to Jack's head. I mean, he thought it might be possible. The start was he was served well by the 35-5 start. Well, then the Tigers, after 35-5, the wheels didn't fall off, but they got a little wobbly because for the next 60 games, they played close to .500 ball. And Jack's season all of a sudden didn't fall apart, but it came back to earth. Well, he got mad. He got mad. And suddenly our questions weren't good questions anymore. They were irritations. And he stopped talking to the media. And then later on, late July, I would say probably, Jack's magic returned a little bit, and he got over his slump. And he made a big deal out of talking to the media again. He wanted to announce to us. He said, okay, I'm talking to you guys again, and as if we were going to thank him. And this was just part of Jack being Jack. I mean, you had to know how to take him. But he did announce to the Free Press, he said, yeah, I'm talking to the media again, but there's one of you guys that I really can't stand, and that's Tom Gage. He knows nothing about baseball. He should be covering shuffleboard. Well, when I wrote The Big 50 and did my first book and did a chapter on Jack, I found this in the archives of the Free Press. And I had forgotten about it because Bill McGraw went on to become an excellent reporter for the Free Press, was covering baseball that year for the Tigers, and he wanted to know my reaction to Jack's comment. I said, well, I don't really have to say anything. Jack's found his scapegoat. And that was my reaction, and the Free Press printed it. But I had forgotten about that too. And we both got a big kick out of the recollection of that when I wrote the chapter on Jack. Jack came across as surly with reporters, and he certainly had his ugly moments. But with the media, all Jack was competitive. One time we were coming back from Boston. It was the day after the series ended, and I got on to a Northwest flight back to Detroit. And as luck would have it, I thought it was bad luck at the time, but it turned into good luck. I was sitting next to Jack, who had, for some reason, was going back the next day as well. And he grumbled, and I kind of grumbled. But we had a great conversation, after which everything was fine with him, because I discovered, you know, that away from the diamond, all of a sudden he lowered his guard, and you got to know Jack really well. They said that about Hal Newhouser one time. The best conversation I ever had with Hal Newhouser is when he was a scout for the Astros, and we were flying down to Miami, I believe it was, for the winter meetings. And I was sitting next to Hal Newhouser, who I'd never had anything other than just a hello with the whole time. And Newhouser was known as an irascible pitcher as well, but he was a delightful guy, and he loved talking baseball. And ever since that flight back from Boston, it was probably mid '80s, Jack, I would say, Jack Morris and I have had an understanding, and I really pulled for him to make it into the Hall of Fame. I always voted for him. He was a big game pitcher. He was a guy that you wanted to be pitching. And I remember him saying, God, what I really want, I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but I want it to happen while my loved ones are still alive to enjoy it. And that meant his parents. And his mother didn't make it, but his dad did. And that really, a lot of things moved Jack to tears, but That's something that also does.
We're talking to Tom Gage, who's written more than 11 million words in his career. Okay, speaking of competitive, Gibby.
Well, a marvelous transformation in that individual. He's a fascinating person, because you didn't want to talk to him after a win, because he didn't want to take credit for anything. So he would often be irritated that you were talking to him about something he deserved credit for. But after losses, when he thought it was his fault, he was good. But the worst thing about Kirk was if he would overhear your question to somebody else and he didn't like it, he would jump on you for it. I remember talking to the Tigers had a backup infielder, great guy, Mick Kelleher, who had a long coaching career as well. And Mick one day let a pop-up fall in, and the Tigers lost because of it. And I had to talk to him afterwards, and he was fine with the line of questioning. But Gibson was just two lockers away, and I remember him bellowing at, give the guy a break, he didn't do it on purpose. And, you know, and got in my face and started. And that was the type of guy he was. I mean, he was. I remember one time there was a story about how Kirk told me that back in when he was Kirk the First, not Kirk the Second, and he was belly aching about something in the Tiger Clubhouse, and Sparky called him in and said, "Blow off steam by causing a confrontation with the media," and so Gibson goes back out to the clubhouse and starts yelling at Brian Bragg of the Free Press. And Brian was a good guy, and it came out of the blue. And there, all of a sudden, he didn't realize that this was instigated by Sparky telling Kirk to blow off steam, and all of a sudden they're having an argument in the clubhouse. Well, that's Sparky knowing how to use the media and also what was best for Kirk to how to blow off steam. But then all of a sudden, when Gibson left, and he had it, you know, he had those, it was certainly that great year, MVP year in L.A., but he began to grow up. I think an incident outside his house in L.A. where he had a gun pulled on him and his family certainly helped to mellow him. But he grew into his own intelligence. And he really became much more mellow. I mean, he's still a fierce competitor, and there are times when if he doesn't understand what you're saying or what you're trying to get at, you can see that you can see Kirk the First still in him, but he treats people a lot better than he used to.
We're talking to Tom Gage, who for 40 years was our eyes and ears about the Detroit Tigers, and you told me at lunch a month or so ago, quote, "I write backwards."
Well, you had to as a beat writer, because most of the 11 million words I wrote about the Tigers were for editions early editions, because we had, back in the day, I mean, when you had to push your button on the deadline story right at the end of the game. So you would write, and it's called running, you would write your first four or five innings, and hopefully the first four or five innings would be eventful, because that would be half your story. You had to have that in the bank after about the sixth inning. Then you would do the seventh and eighth as being the top two-thirds of the second half of your story, and then hope that you could top it with a good lead at the end. But, Jack, you had to press your button right at the end of the office expected it as soon after the final pitch of the game, as fast as you could get it in. And it was only then that you would go downstairs to add quotes to the story, or possibly, if it was a day game, rewrite it completely. But that first story always had to be in that final pitch.
We're talking to Tom Gage. When we come back, we're going to ask him about July 25th, 2015. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Tom Gage, whose third book has just been published. It's entitled Three, and it's about Alan Trammell. Tom, let's go back July 25th, 2015. You're in Cooperstown. You and Dick Enberg, oh my, Dick Enberg, are honored by the Baseball Hall of Fame. You've got 50 Hall of Famers seated behind you. Tell us about that day.
Absolutely magical. I'm just glad I went first ahead of Dick, because I knew that if he had gone first, it would have been kind of And here's the writer, too, you know. But I had to deliver about a 15-minute speech that day, and I wrote it pretty quickly, and that wasn't the problem. The problem was delivering it, because, you know, I'm not on order, and I knew Dick Enberg would be. But I practiced it. I hired I paid a coach to help me, and I got up that morning, and, you know, the Hall of Fame, even they treat writers and broadcasters alike. I mean, you get honored by the Hall of Fame. You don't get inducted into the Hall of Fame as a writer. But they treat you just like a king. They really do. So that Saturday, I wake up and I'm happy with my speech, but I knew I needed, it was a speech of stories, of different stories that I wanted to humor the crowd. But I needed one more anecdote. And my niece came out with her two little girls from Detroit for the speech. And that morning, Jenny, one of her daughters, said, "You know, Mom, I know where I want to live when I grow up." And she, "Well, Jenny, where do you want to live?" "Right here in Cooperstown." "And why is that?" "Well, because this afternoon, Uncle Tom is going into the Hall of Fame. But when everybody leaves, he'll be all alone." She thought that going into the Hall of Fame meant I had to live in the Hall of Fame. So that was the little anecdote that I was looking for to help launch the speech. And I have to say I was very comfortable delivering it, but to have all those great Hall of Famers behind you was absolutely special. And their reaction, you know, having them congratulate you for the speech. Sandy Koufax, after Dick Enberg was done, came across the stage just to congratulate me. And that's one of the great moments of my career, because not only does Koufax not often go to the Hall of Fame, but he's not known for doing things for doing things like that. And it really was I tell the other writers who get honored now, you know, set your sights high, because it's going to be the most special weekend of your professional career, but it will exceed all your expectations. And it really did.
Speaking of exceeding expectations, you covered major league games in 54 parks and more than 5,000 games. And you said the best player you ever watched was?
Well, the classiest player I ever watched was Alan Trammell. He just treated people the right way. He played the game, I hate to say it, but the right way. I mean, that's a cliche, but he did. Jack, he did. I mean, everything he did was textbook, whether it was going into the hole to get the would-be single or behind second. That's still the defensive play I see in my mind's eye of Alan Trammell does is behind second, spinning, and throwing a strike to first base. Offensively, the play that I see is the double over third base and him ending up on second with a first inning double. Trammell wasn't he had his spectacular moments, but everything just seemed to be perfect, except for one play. I remember going down to, I would sit upstairs, but Ed Browalski, who was the longtime scorer for the Tigers, invited me down to his to where he would score, and it was on the broadcast level where Ernie and Paul were. And one time, there was a ground ball into the hole. Trammell couldn't get to it. It was an obvious base hit. But as he was completing the play, he kicked the ball. And that allowed the runner to go to second. So Ed turned to me and said, "Double?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure, Ed. He doesn't get to second if Tram doesn't kick the ball." So he said, "Single and an error?" I would think so. And somehow it got back to Tram that it was my decision to give him an error. And I remember getting into an argument. He said, "Yeah, but that ball was in the hole. It was hard to get to." I said, "But you kicked it." And I said, That's why it was an error. So that was the one imperfect play that I remember him for. And unfortunately, I got the blame for the call. But I stand by the call. But ever since then, I'm glad I'm not an official scorer.
Tom has just published his third book entitled Three. 14,000 words in 6 weeks. It's about Alan Trammell. Let's go back to Sunday, August 26th, Comerica Park, Tram's Day. Talk about that celebration.
Oh, it was wonderful. I thought he was much more relaxed for that event and for that ceremony and in his speech than he was for the Hall of Fame. His Hall of Fame speech was good, but and it covered all the bases. But it was somewhat formulaic, I thought. I mean, he looked like it was just a speech to get through. But you could see his true joy, I think, in front of the crowd at Comerica Park when they retired his number. And I felt he was much more relaxed. And I'm very happy for him that that his number's been retired. It's not a number that was worn by all that many Tigers over the years, about 20. I mean, Dick McAuliffe wore it, and Charlie Gehringer wore it before he switched to two. It was the first number he wore in 1931, but a lot of obscure players wore it as well. So it wasn't a really classic number in Tiger history, but it certainly is now.
Speaking of classic, can you share with us one fantastic story in the book about Tram?
Well, his two sisters, Lynn and Nancy, really helped with the book. They helped send family photos of Tram when he was 1 year old, and with the three of them dressed up for Easter and as kids, and also Alan going talking to Santa Claus. But she shared this story about when she was running for class president in high school, and her mother would help her with her speech, and time after time she would lose. And she said it almost became embarrassing, because I ran for class president so often. I thought, okay, this one last time I'm going to try it. And she's 4 years older than Alan is, and by the time she was running for president again, he was beginning to play baseball at school and getting to a good reputation. She might have been a senior and he was in the eighth grade, but she won finally. And one of the high school seniors, one of the boys, came up to her and said, "We voted for you this time, and that's why you won." And she said, "Well, great, thank you so much, but why suddenly did you vote for me?" "Because your brother's going to be a heck of a ball player." And so that even then, he was having a profound influence on those who were close to him.
Tom Gage, for 40 years, you were our eyes and ears for the Detroit Tigers. Brought us phenomenal joy through the great years and the 2000 years, 2003 years, etc. Thanks much. Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you, Jack. Really enjoyed it.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.
Believe in yourself.